You are listening to Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Club. I'm your host, Frederick C. Blackburn. Welcome everyone to the Trading Post this evening. Tonight's episode is episode 97, and it is titled Two Experiments Set Up to Fail. And we're going to be looking at the history of South Africa and the history of my home state of North Carolina, or as I call it, North Kakalaki. And I just, the more I learn about South Africa and what's going on there, I just see so much similarity to what has gone on and is going on in my state of North Carolina. And like we always talk about, that South Africa is basically the test bed, the sandbox for what the world Zionists have in store for the rest of us, being the United States, Canada, the UK, Europe, Australia, New Zealand, that, you know, they are serious about wanting white genocide, that is part of the agenda for Pax Judaica. And so when, you know, you think about the experiments that we talk about that were things like the United States, when it was these United States, what that original distributed peer-to-peer republic was about, that was about open source laws where, you know, you elect people that write the laws and everybody gets to see what the laws are. There are no secret laws. Everybody's following by the same set of laws at the state level, the local level, and the federal level. You know, this idea of one rule for all versus previous systems that were a two-tiered legal system of, you know, the master-slave. You got one rules for the masters and their peers and another rules for the slaves. And so this idea of the great experiment as, you know, changing that to self-rule. And, you know, the idea of minting their own money and establishing their own economic model versus using a Jewish private central bank money laundering, lending, extortion, usury type system. So that idea of, you know, having their own currencies and their own laws and having these family-based cultures that, you know, just so much of what happened in North Carolina I see in the history with the, you know, similar groups of Europeans going to colonize and create a new type of society, that, you know, new peer-to-peer society where you were free to progress and to build and not be shut down, you know, by the old world systems. And so the other things that were faced in these two great experiments of the North Carolina Project and the South Africa Project was that you had homogeneous sets of people with, you know, common belief systems in your communities. That's what your communities were made up of. But you also were dealing with an indigenous population that was fundamentally different than you were. Not only were there sociological factors, but there were biological factors involved here. And so one of the biggest parts of any type of experiments is, what do you do with the indigenous populations as you're going through your growth cycles? And is equality possible? Is assimilation of those indigenous peoples possible? Or is what you're trying to do too abstract of a concept for them to take part in fully? And so these were the kind of questions that, you know, were brought up during this age of exploration, the age of colonization. And also just, you know, is self-rule possible? So, you know, if you read the rioters during this time that were standing up for the old systems, especially the feudal systems, you know, it was kind of like the mutiny on the Bounty story where you have Captain Bly, who is the seasoned captain of the ship that has been through it all. And you know, one thing, you know, he was the guy you wanted when the chips were down because he knew how to survive when things got tough. And then you had the young mutineer who almost gets everyone killed because he's such a bad leader once he seized power. And so, you know, the idea of what happens with the Americans, for example, after the Revolutionary War, is it going to just descend into chaos, or will they be able to keep order in this self-ruled experiment? And the same thing with, you know, the colonies going down to South Africa is, you know, once they have that distance, will they be able to keep order there, especially in this type of setting? So, and the other aspect is the role of religion had shifted so much with the technology that now the holy books of the society were in the hands of not the priest class only, but in the hands of the kings and queens, all the royals, also the middle class, and available to the poor that were clever enough to, you know, be able to get their hands on, you know, the books to read them. You know, the idea was that, you know, this side of Gutenberg's Bible, that the modern printing press with movable typeset brought in the new ways of making paper, made it possible for those holy books to be in the hands of the individual. So these ideas of, you know, church communities, these little pockets of people that were figuring out how to do self-rule and trying to justify it on their interpretation of scripture versus previous systems of, say, papacy in Rome that was, you know, dictating church official church policy. So, you know, you had this idea of, you know, post-Reformation, post-Protestant revolution of thought. And so these factors, you know, went into so much of what we call the, you know, the colonial period, which now is the favorite topic apparently of all these anti-white groups, is, you know, everything about this age of exploration, age of colonization was intrinsically bad, intrinsically evil, and white people need to just die. So, yeah. But anyway, so, we're faced with a huge experiment to begin with. And so just trying to make this work on its own merits would be difficult enough. But once we start seeing the rest of the story, we know that from day one, there has always been a cabal of people that had a different end game in mind of where they thought the world should be heading, and it should be under their rule, not Western civilization's rule anymore, that they should be the dominant and fix everything that Western civilization had messed up in the last 4,000 or 6,000 years. And so, you know, this you know, basically, it was such a, you know, long development over the last 2,000 years, especially. But, you know, the key thing is knowing that throughout these great experiments, there was always that hidden hand knocking everything down, sabotaging it to try to make it fail so that it could be replaced with their model. And that's the part that you really aren't taught in school, that there were two systems at play in everything that happened in, you know, the search for the new world, if you will. So, like we always do, you know, here at the Training Post, we start out either at the last ice age or at the beginning of the Piscean age. So here we're going to start at T6, last great ice age, and then T5, gold era, about 22,000 to 16,000 BC. And remember, this is, you know, our great year, that full circle of the zodiac from the last great ice age to now. You know, we were, as the last great ice age was ending, we were in an Aquarian age. Now we're in Aquarian age, one cycle in the future, if you will. So the silver era, you know, this was so important, you know, in that 16,000 to 10,000 BC, because that's when those calendar systems, those lunar calendar systems, really got established. Now, we know that we've had the lunar calendar from the oldest 28-day calendar piece of sculpture we found, which is the La Salle Venus, that's dated to about 30,000 BC. So, but during that period is when the European calendar, that seasonal change, 13th month, laid the foundation of so much of Western civilization, that, you know, especially moving into an agrarian society from a hunter-gatherer society. And then during the copper era, 10,000 to 4,000, yeah, that's when you started to see the city-state model, the fertility temples, the this type of system, though. You hear echoes of it in fables like the story of Sleeping Beauty, where you had the 13 fairies, and suddenly one of the fairies isn't invited because one of the plates, the round white thing, a plate like a moon shape, one of the plates got broken. So that was that transition of moving from the lunar calendar to the 12-month solar calendar. So 13 gave way to 12, and suddenly 13 was an unlucky number. That was the old way of those T3 systems. And now, you know, in the iron era, you're moving into these solar type systems. And so that transition, like I said, is so much of this is you see it echoed in the fairy tales and the folklore, and also in the games and the vice of the current age. It's like, you know, that's what they always say, vice was virtue in a previous time. Then also during this time period, you had the 13th horoscope sign in the ecliptic, in the zodiac, which was the snake handler, or Ophicius, and that was located between Sagittarius and Scorpio. And so, you know, you had that. And so we move into, you know, our iron era, and, you know, we talk about that was key about metalwork. But one of the fascinating things about when we started discovering working with metals was that idea of the metal that moves. The idea of a magnet, you know, or the lodestone, and that would lead to not only the foundation of the study of electricity and magnetism and the entire electromagnetic spectrum, but also the idea of the magnetic fields of Earth always pointing in one direction. So when we look at the Iron Era, you know, some of the symbols that we see about that is, you know, the idea of the symbol of like the fascist, for example, this bundled sticks with the axe with the strap wrapped around them and all the sticks going the same way. Well, as we move into that, you know, the development of maps. So now you have your calendars, and then you have your maps. And then you can orient the maps not based on geographical things, but now starting to base it on the position of the sun and the sundial systems. And then the idea of a metal that will always point to a magnetic north, that, you know, there's something in the north that draws things to it. And that is alluded to in a lot of the Freemason symbolism of the chair of Hiram Abiff that is left vacant in the north. So the north is always that dark spot in the Freemason lodge. And so these symbols that came out of, you know, the Iron Era of, you know, first the metalwork and then fascism. And the first time we really see the fascist symbol is around 700 BC with the Etruscans. And another key thing about this time is boats. We've had boats and canoes and those kind of things in the biological record for quite some time. But it was during around 2000 BC where you start seeing tales of Jason and the Argonauts, and the Argo was the ship that was designed to carry multiple men. So suddenly you have these groups of men united into these armies on ships sailing together. And that idea of these oars that are parallel and, you know, rowing together. And if you've ever tried to row together with somebody, that takes some doing. And, you know, it's not as easy as it looks. And so this idea of, you know, the symbols of, you know, men moving forward and then moving into ships and sailing together into ships. In 2006 BC was the first time we saw the magnetic compass, and this was invented in China. And interesting enough, it was originally used in the Han Dynasty for divination. It wasn't used for any kind of navigation, but for divining purposes. And so the Han Dynasty was from about 206 BC to about 220 AD. Now, as we move into the Piscean Age, you know, the key things there is, of course, the 70 AD, the Temple at Jerusalem is destroyed, and of course, the birth, passion, and resurrection story that lays the foundation for the rise of Christianity and Western civilization. So, you know, that battle of the temple being destroyed in Rome, like we always say, that never ended. And that's one of the key things of understanding your history, especially in the last, you know, 2,000 years, is that, you know, that battle has been going on, and everything has been these two factions at war with each other. This, you know, the shadow cabal undermining what this other system is trying to do, because it, like I said, it has a different end game in mind. It wants the temple rebuilt and that to be the, you know, city of the world, basically, and all the uppity Amalek need to perish so that they have their Noahide law model, you know, their brave new world model, that new Babylon, that seven-layer model, and then the abracadabra. You know, we talk about that symbolism. A lot of people have been sending me Tower of Babel symbols this week, which is kind of interesting, the synchronicity. And a lot of them have the 11 stars of the abracadabra bell curve that we, you know, talk about being the IQ distribution of the, and then you have the alpha, betas, gammas, deltas, classes, and then you have that elite 777 hidden class at the very, very top, you know, those kind of systems. Once you understand, you know, that there's this other system out there that is carrying out star chamber justice against everybody else that gets in their way, this, you know, Piscean Age definitely makes a lot more sense, especially when it comes to the New World exploration models of things like North Carolina and South Africa, that, you know, they had different ideas for those territories. So it was in 1000 AD during the Song Dynasty that the magnetic compass was first used for navigation in China. Now in China, They talk about China's four great inventions that they gave to the world, and the magnetic compass was one, which of course was, you know, the invented in 2006 and used for navigation 1000 AD, but the 2006 BC, excuse me. Gunpowder, which was originally used for fireworks around 1000 AD. Paper making, different phases in the paper making, from actual paper that you wrote on to paper that you used to wrap things and insulate things with. You know, there's a big spectrum of time there, but that idea of paper making, and then printing. And the printing goes back, you know, to around 300 BC. And it was from here that so much of that influenced the West. But, you know, those are known as the four great inventions of China. And, of course, the magnetic compass was one of them. Now, we always talk about, you know, this cabal always needs foot soldiers. And so in 1118, the Knights Templars found it. In 1099, the Priory of Zion was founded. So, yeah, there's your basis of that world Zionism coming back. And, of course, they went to the Temple Mount. They dug up something under the Temple Mount and returned as superstars amongst the Jewish elite in Europe. And, you know, during this time period, you know, over 109 times, or 109 areas, over 200 times, they were thrown out. And it wasn't because of irrational anti-Semitism. So in 1290, for example, the Jews were expelled from England. Now, there's very interesting the way things developed in British history while the Jews were gone, expelled. And then you see this rapid change and reversal of policy once the Jews come back into England, especially and set up the city of London and that, you know, huge banking cartel of the Warburgs and the Rothschilds and all of this. But so at the same time, you know, the Jews are being expelled from England. At 1300 AD, Marco Polo's book of the Marvels of the World comes out, and he lived from 1254 to 1324. And that is such a barometer of where east-west travel had established itself, so that suddenly you had the new, you know, trade routes into the east, and so much of this technology like the compass would be moving into Europe. So in 13 AD, compasses began to appear in both medieval Europe and in the Islamic world for navigation. In 1306, the Jews were thrown out of France. And 1307, all the Knights Templars were arrested. And then 1492, Columbus sailed for the New World, and the Jews were thrown out of Spain. So this kind of gives you the sense of urgency of the Jews realizing that they have got to get a homeland. And in this age of exploration, suddenly they had more options. So in 1487, a Portuguese explorer, Bartolomeu Dias, led the first European voyage to land in South Africa. And then in 1488, John II of Portugal names the Cape of Good Hope. And at the time, of course, there were indigenous peoples there. And then, of course, to add to Judaism's woes, in 1530, you know, Nicholas Copernicus writes The Revolution of the Heavenly Spheres, and that shifted the worldview from a geocentric model to a heliocentric model. And all of Judaism's traditional symbolism is all about that seven-candle menorah of the free-willed, seven free-willed planets that basically they adopted from that Babylonian system. So it's all keyed on this geocentric model. So that really shook, you know, the core of Judaism's belief system, if you will, you know, and that, you know, what is God questioning. In 1558, Queen Elizabeth is crowned Queen of England, and she would be key in establishing so much of the exploration of North America, especially the areas where the United States would develop. So in 1566, Juan Pardo, a Spanish explorer, explores the area of North Carolina, South Carolina, and eastern Tennessee. So here the Spanish are coming in and exploring this area of the Appalachian Mountains. And then in 1567, Juan Yardo establishes Fort San Juan near the present-day town of Morganton, North Carolina, which is in Burke County, which is about 50 miles from where I am, maybe. This only lasted about 18 months before the local indigenous people killed all but one of the 120 men stationed at the total of 6 forts in the area. This is one of the things that I think public education really does a disservice to history in the way it describes this period. This age of exploration into these tribal lands, there were very strict taboos on territory, and so you would get these full massacre type scenarios where they would kill every single person. So the European development of warfare was very, very different than what they were encountering with these indigenous people. And like I said, this was a big shocker that they established these forts, 6 forts in the area, and within 18 months, all but one of the 120 armed and trained men that were stationed there were all killed. Then in 1584, Queen Elizabeth of England grants Sir Walter Raleigh a royal charter to explore this area of North Carolina and Virginia. And in 1587, of course, 1584, he sent over Philip Amadis and Arthur Barlow to establish the Roanoke Colony in Virginia. And Sir Walter Raleigh is key to North Carolina history especially, and now our capital city is named after Sir Walter Raleigh, Raleigh, North Carolina, of course. Then in 1587, they tried a second colony at Roanoke under John White, and then in 1607, you had the first permanently settled English colony, and it was called the Colony and Dominion of Virginia. So that was the first official colonization of a permanent colony. Now, in 1652, Jan van Riebeck, and I probably just pronounced that wrong, established Cape Town for the benefit of Dutch East India. And so one of the key things they wanted with the Cape was basically a waypoint, refueling, restocking type station there for ships coming around Africa and then going eastward and then making their way back so that they could come to port, do repairs, do trading, refuel, restock everything, and then move on. Yeah, so that was kind of the plan for that project. Now, in 1663, the province of Carolina was established. And when you look at how these pre-colonial territories were laid out, there were three types of provinces you could have. You could have a proprietary, a royal, a joint stock, or a covenant. And North Carolina was part of the Carolina province, and it was set up originally as a proprietary system where basically the person who had the deed owned the property and then had to give back a share to the crown. And then in 1712, Carolina divided into the province of North Carolina and South Carolina. And it was during 1655 is when you really started seeing a big influx of Jews coming back into England, especially into London, and getting established. A lot were filtering in as far back as Henry VIII, some under Queen Elizabeth, but really under Cromwell is when you started seeing Jews really getting established. So this is when you start seeing things change in British politics, if you will. In 1722, the original capital of North Carolina was selected to be Edenton, and then in 1729, North Carolina becomes a crown property, and it was mainly made up of Scotch, Irish, Quaker, English, and German immigrants. the other thing there was that you didn't have a lot of those people coming in with their slaves. You know, they were coming in to try to get established and bringing in families and livestock and tools to set up communities. A lot of times you were seeing churches coming over with congregations to start, you know, a community based on their leadership, either a council or a charismatic individual who had a way of setting up a self-sustaining community in the new world, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, so you didn't have as many of the big Jewish slave plantations as you did in areas such as like Charleston, South Carolina, or Savannah, Georgia, or New Orleans, you know, or in the New England. And so it's interesting when people really try to put slavery on to North Carolina, you know, you have to really set them straight with the Jewish history of, you know, where did slavery exist in the New World, and especially North Carolina. You know, there weren't that many Christian families. There were some, you know, I'm not saying they were completely innocent, but, you know, the majority, you look at the Jewish interest in this, and North Carolina just really wasn't set up to be a big slave plantation, especially compared to what was going on in the Caribbean islands, for example. Then, of course, in 1776, North Carolina supported independence from England and joined the colonies against, you know, the crown, and won its independence as one of the first original 13 colonies that became the first 13 states of these United States. And then in 1792, Raleigh was selected as the state capital and the county seat after Sir Walter Raleigh. And then in 1789, the University of North Carolina was established in the town of Chapel Hill, just below the city of Raleigh. And it was in 1829 that the University of Cape Town was established, making it the oldest university in South Africa. The University of North Carolina is one of the three schools in the United States that claim to be the oldest public university. So, you know, North Carolina, one of the first things we established was the University of North Carolina in 1789. And unfortunately, you know, that whole network has been completely taken over by the Marxists, and it's just complete propaganda now. And that was part of what stirred me to do this show was Friday night. The public television station here, which is operated by the university system, ran a segment on the statues in South Africa causing strife in this post-apartheid South Africa. And it was such a fluff piece. They just, you know, of course, showed the blacks to be the struggling victims, and the whites were the horrible oppressors, all just Nazis, etc. You know, just, I'm exaggerating, but it was really an over-the-top propaganda piece, and made no mention whatsoever of the farm murders going on in South Africa, the status as white genocide. They're in stage six of complete white genocide. No mention of any of that. And I put it in this week's playlist. But it was just so shocking to see the view of South Africa that they were trying to sell to the people who watch public television in North Carolina. And that's how people, the intellectuals that watch public TV, of course, and listen to NPR, you know, that's their worldview of South Africa. And it's a very skewed view, and it's a very Marxist view, propaganda, because it's promoting what the Jew view of South Africa could be versus what the Boer view and the British view of what South Africa should be. And the white people that are being genocided, what they think South Africa should be and what it currently is. Now, in 1795 to 1803 is when you had Great Britain occupying Cape Town. And so here you start to see the beginnings of the friction between the original Boers, which were the, you know, German and Dutch settlers moving down, and then the British moving in. And again, you know, you're looking at the British Navy as the biggest superpower in the world at the time. After the Napoleonic Wars in 1803 to 1815, South Africa is officially ceded to the UK and became part of the British Empire. Meanwhile, in the United States in 1830 to 1850, this is when you started seeing the U.S. Indian Removal Act. And one of the most well-known episodes of this is the so-called Trail of Tears, where the Cherokee population was moved onto reservation systems in the western states. And we also have a Cherokee reservation here in North Carolina in the mountains. But, you know, this is where you started seeing the official policy of whether or not the indigenous people are going to be able to assimilate into the new model. And also the concern, which very few civilizations have ever had this concern before, is the loss of a culture, and that, you know, resource was provided so that these people could, if they wanted to, go and preserve their way of living on a small scale and not where they're originally from, type of thing. And so trying to attack it or defend it, I'm just saying that that is what happened in that part of the Great Experiment model of how the Americans dealt with an indigenous population assimilation problem and also preserving a culture that wanted to be preserved. And then, of course, in 1861 to 1865, you had the U.S. Civil War between the North and the South. North Carolina was part of the Confederacy. We were part of the Southern states, and so technically we lost, we were on the losing side of that war. And several people have done great research, like Mr. Mike King. We did a show on a three-part series, actually, on the U.S. Uncivil War, as I called it, and talked about the Jewish influence in that war and the Masonic influence of the, you know, the Freemasons at play in that model, and also foreign influence, both from the Jewish banking model, UK, etc., and to show, you know, how the only people who really benefited from that war were the Jews, just like World War I, World War II, and so many of these other wars of the Jewish century. And so this end of the war would set about what was called Reconstruction. And so in 1877, the U.S. instituted what they called Reconstruction Segregation Law, where you couldn't have slavery anymore, but it wasn't a what they would call a diversity, multicultural, everybody equal society either. You had what they called in South Africa apartheid laws, or as they're called in the United States, Jim Crow laws. And the idea was separate but equal, that, you know, you would have, you know, blacks living amongst blacks. And here in North Carolina, not only was primary school and secondary school provided, but also we had numerous public black colleges and universities that were put in place during this time period. Then in 1879 in South Africa is when you had the Anglo-Zulu War between the British and the Zulu tribes. And so they were fighting with an indigenous population of this very aggressive Zulu tribe. And then in 1880 to 1881 is when you had the first Boer War against, you know, the Boers and the British fighting it out. And then in 1899 to 1902, you had the second Boer War that ended with British defeating the Boers. And this is when you first saw modern concentration camps of civilians and using those as a way to kill people. You know, you, when you see the British model of those concentration camps and how many women and children died, and then you see the Eisenhower death camps after World War II, you know, it's basically the same model that they were using. And so it's one of the videos in, actually one of the hints for today's show was Adolf Hitler in one of his speeches describing this tactic that the British used against the Boer in the introduction of these concentration camps. And so that was one of those horrors of modern warfare that was introduced to culture. In 1909, British Parliament passes the South Africa Act, basically giving a nominal independence to South Africa. Then the 1910, the Union of South Africa is created. In the United States in 1909, the NAACP is founded. And it's interesting that the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People in this separate but equal society was all financed and funded and managed by Jewish interests. You know, so you actually had Jews in all the key positions of the NAACP, and their main thing was to go and tell black people that separate but equal isn't good enough and to agitate for what would become the civil rights movement. And so in 1913 in South Africa, they had the Native Land Act, which imposed severe restrictions on land ownership by blacks. So here you're seeing actual legislation coming in to say the indigenous people cannot own land. And this is very similar to what we were seeing with states like North Carolina dealing with their indigenous people, saying, well, we're going to move you from here to there, and also restricting their ownership of land. And then in 1923 is when the Jewish Pan-Europa Manual, otherwise known as the Kalergi Plan, is released. And that describes how to carry out white genocide in basically a fourth generation distributed cell warfare manner using mass immigration of non-white populations and aggressive populations into these genteel white communities. And so that's how far back, you know, that idea of genocide via immigration goes. This is 1923. So then in 1931, South Africa achieves full independence from the UK. And in 1934, the South Africa Party and the National Party merged into what is known as the United Party. This unity stayed pretty intact until 1939, when the South Africa United Party split with the Nationalists over World War II, and it was basically South Africa wanted to go in as an ally of the UK. The Nationalist Party strongly opposed that because they preferred Germany and the National Socialists, of course. In 1941 is when Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941, that's when Japan attacked the United States, and suddenly the United States and North Carolina found itself in World War II, fighting against not only the Japanese, but against Britain and the central bank's enemy, Germany, and Italy as well. And so people like my father and all my uncles, you know, promptly started going to, you know, military installations to go to fight in this war. So again, there was a lot of, like we talked about in last week's show, there was a lot of heated discussion on whether or not the United States should get involved in another European war. If we did, whose side should we fight on? Because there was a lot of German influence in the United States at the time, and most people liked them more than the British, because remember, we had fought two wars against the British, one, you know, in 1776 and one in 1812, which, you know, didn't go into here, but, you know, so there was a lot of consternation, especially in the southern states, about going to war. But nevertheless, you know, we went to war against Germany. In 1948, South Africa National Party elected to power, and that's when you started seeing their racial segregation laws begin. Their, you know, Jim Crow laws, if you will, their separate but equal, their apartheid years. You know, so that 1948 is when it started there. In the United States in 1954 is when you had Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. And this was the landmark show trial case that went to sell the idea that separate but equal, separated black and white public schools were unconstitutional. Okay. And when you look at that, again, you see the heavy hand of the hidden hand in all of that, of the, especially the propaganda where it was showing, you know, these schools and, you know, just trying to really put a disparity between what the black children were getting and what the white children were getting. And again, always doing that Marxist call of equality, you know, the big battle cry of equality, equality, equality. In 1960 in North Carolina is when we had the sit-ins of the civil rights movements. And it's interesting that that happened at a Woolworth store. And if you remember a few shows back, we talked about the rise of the company Walmart. And in that show, we talked about the rise of these department stores and five and dimes, as they were called, like Woolworths, and how Jewish owned and controlled so much of the Woolworths franchise was. And so it's interesting that this Woolworths in Greensboro, North Carolina, that had the soda fountain, little cafe, did not escalate the situation to have these black students removed during their sit-in, and that the press and all the Jewish media got behind this action, and anybody who tried to speak out against it was, of course, demonized because they were using these peaceful protest methods. And so to me, that whole Woolworths sit-in was staged crisis theater in the 1960s to push the civil rights agenda. In 1961, South Africa becomes, you know, a official republic. And then 1965 in the U.S. passes the Voting Rights Act. And, excuse me, 1964, the U.S. passed the Civil Rights Act, which completely did away with all the separate but equal Jim Crow apartheid laws in the United States at a federal level. So this was key because the states were no longer allowed to choose how they wanted to deal with their populations along these race lines. It used to be a states' right issues under the 10th Amendment of the Constitution. But suddenly you had this federal Civil Rights Act in 1964 that they said trumped states' rights on this issue. And then, of course, the 65 Voting Rights Act. So now they you have this population that has full voting rights. So once they get to a majority, they are going to, of course, vote the minority whites out. And this is what we're seeing now with the mass immigration cities that have become non-white cities. Come election time, they're going to be voting for the socialist programs. And so they vote Democrat because they get the Morse Gibbs, if you will. And of course, in 1965, the U.S. passed the Immigration Act, which just opened the floodgates to the third world to attack all these white communities. 1968, Martin Luther was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. That, again, the one of the things about all these declassified documents about the Kennedy assassination, I'm not finding out all that much more that I didn't already know about the Kennedy assassination, but we are really finding out a lot about who Martin Luther King really was versus his brand image that was presented by the Jewish media as a political meme, if you will. He was to be that charismatic, peaceful leader leading his people to the Holy Land, etc., and just that pious individual, the minister, etc., and that was apparently not who the man was at all. And that the FBI and all these other agencies knew this at the time, and all this information was classified, again, because it went against the agenda, the Jewish agenda of race tensions in the United States. In 1974 in South Africa, the Malabatini Declaration of Faith is signed by Mangosuthu Buthelezi, who was the Zulu tribal leader at the time, and a lawyer by the name of Harry Schwartz, who is, of course, Jewish. This was basically a manifesto for so-called civil rights and equality in South Africa. So it's basically the Jews organizing the blacks and uniting them against the non-Jewish whites in South Africa under the guise of establishing democracy and equality. Now, in 1990, the National Party government removes the ban on the African National Congress Party in South Africa, the ANC government, and releases Nelson Mandela from prison. So in 1990, Nelson Mandela is released from prison. He becomes that poster child in the international Jew media of the new Martin Luther King saint who is leading his people to the promised land, etc. And the ANC government is now legitimized. They are no longer banned. In 1994, in the United States, the NAFTA agreement is signed by Bill Clinton, which is the North American Free Trade Agreement between Canada, United States, and Mexico. And this really fueled the influx of Mexicans into the United States, especially the U.S. South. In 1994, South Africa held its first universal elections, and the ANC, the African National Congress, won by an overwhelming majority and has held power ever since. And so basically the National Party opened up the elections, promptly lost the elections with no chance of ever regaining those seats of power ever again. And this was all due to international pressure of the anti-apartheid movement that was completely Jewish-controlled, Jewish-financed, and Jewish-orchestrated. And now we're seeing full-blown white genocide in South Africa. In 2013, Julius Malema and former African National Congress Youth League members formed the Economic Freedom Fighters, or the EFF, and this is an even more radical group than the ANC is. The EFF, the Economic Freedom Fighters, are full-blown Marxists that call for the full extinction of white people in South Africa. That is part of their platform, is white genocide, and they are outspoken about it. And especially this Julius Malema character, if you watch any of his videos, you know, he is all about, you know, this narrative of those evil white people came and stole everything, and it's time for them to pay. Meanwhile, in 2013, Black Lives Matter, or BLM, is founded in the United States, and it was basically the synthetic product of the hyped up Zimmerman gun trial in Florida, which, you know, echoes through all these Antifa protests today of the hands up, don't shoot, where you basically are making a martyr out of this black person to demonize all white people and to continue this meme of police brutality and victim class, which is, you know, that's so key to the Marxist model, is these Jews go out and they find people and convince them they're victims, they're owed something, and then rile up the people to force this type of, you know, military level conflict, you know, social disturbance, agitation, agitprop, as they call it. So, you know, we've got Black Lives Matter all over the United States, especially in the South now, doing all kinds of communist, you know, Marxist, anti-white work. And they're being trained and financed and equipped by all of these very well organized and trained and equipped Jewish groups. So it's interesting that also in 2013 is when Harvard professor Noel Ignatieff, who is a Jewish supremacist, make no bones about it, he's 100% Jews are superior. But this is a Harvard professor in the United States who said in 2013, the same year that gave us Joseph Malema and the EFF party and George Soros' Black Lives Matter, he says, "We intend to keep bashing the dead white males and the live ones and the females too until the social construct known as the white race is destroyed. Not deconstructed, but destroyed." And so here you have it. You know, that is part of the agenda, be it in South Africa or in little old North Kakalaki, USA. But this is, you know, what we're up against. So anyway, so with that said, I'd like to thank everyone for joining us on the Breakfast Club tonight. And I hope everyone has a wonderful week and a wonderful Wacky Wednesday the rest of it, and I really appreciate it. All the wonderful birthday greetings today, all day long. That's why I couldn't get any work done. I kept laughing at all these wonderful birthday greetings. And also, thank you so much for all the people who made donations today on my birthday. I really appreciated that. We definitely have lots of expenses getting ready for winter. But with that said, thanks again for showing up and spending my birthday with me, crew. And until next time, I will see you all at the rendezvous.
Do you begin to smell some funky little things going on? Let me share this story with you. It's not so much a story, it's something I wrote years ago. Read your history, people. Stock markets collapse on Friday. Bank seizures, closures, holidays take place after business hours on Friday. Do currencies or governments also collapse on Friday? Tomorrow's Friday. Will the end come on this Friday, or will the inevitable collapse hold off for a while? The next round of the worst financial crisis in 100 years is coming, people, and the government is out to make you and I pay for it. And will your savings survive a global banking wipeout? What happens when the U.S. sees hyperinflation? What if taxes soar not only for the rich? Can you survive if the stock market tanks? Look, between a stock market wipeout, waves of bank failures, soaring government spending that will lead to hyperinflation, and the destruction of the dollar's value, isn't it time that you prepare for the uncertainty which lies ahead? Protect your money now, or forever kiss it goodbye. My friends, I offer you over 6 decades' experience of hard asset ownership and knowledge, and I'm prepared to handle the smallest detail in the balanced protection of your portfolio. For as the future of uncertainty continues to blanket this nation of ours, I believe that I can offer you the privacy, safety, security, and possibly some profitability which you deserve. And so I invite you to visit SierraMadrePreciousMetals.com for further information regarding protecting your wealth. Or call me, Jeffrey Bennett, at 602-799-8214. Or by email at KettleMoraineLTD@Cox.net for private consultation. Once again, our phone number, 602-799-8214. It's almost Friday.
Are you one of the millions of people who feel like there is a dark cloud hanging over their heads whenever they're using pharmaceutical drugs? For some, the short-term relief can turn into an opioid addiction nightmare. Have you ever wondered why CBD oil is a billion-dollar industry? It's because it works better than opioids and is actually healthy for you. However, CBD oil is stripped of all other helpful compounds found in the hemp plant. According to neuroscientists, the whole hemp plant, otherwise known as hemp paste, is even more effective than the chemically processed CBD oil. Are you ready to take back your health? You can try hemp paste by going to rbnhemppaste.com. That's rbnhemppaste.com.